You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello there, I'm Ollie Southgate, and from the Broadway Podcast Network, this is Putting It Together, where usually I sit down with Broadway's best business minds to talk about the state of the art and their role in keeping the world's biggest theatre town at the top of the list. This month, though, as the pandemic continues to keep hundreds of thousands of arts jobs around the world hanging in the balance, now for over a year in many cases, I'm discussing a serious but often undiscussed issue faced by the global live entertainment industry. On today's show, I'm talking to an arts industry survivor from my home in the UK, Meg Massey, the woman behind burnout coach Maggie's Supernova, about the highs and, more importantly, the lows of working in the commercial theatre business and the warning signs to watch out for to avoid letting a high-speed career hit a brick wall.
I think that the unique thing about theatre is that it is our entire lives, it's our entire passion, and so it hits us so hard when it kind of turns against us, when burnout strikes.
We discuss how her passion and personality helped her thrive in the arts, but ultimately reached a boiling point, the traits that leave both employees and employers more susceptible to the perils of burnout, and how she's now using her experience to help others avoid it. So let's find out how Meg Massey puts it all together and how she's now learning to keep it all together. A quick editor's note first, though. About halfway through this episode, you'll notice that the sound of Meg's voice changes pretty drastically. I wasn't going to mention it, but as I was editing today, I realised it would be pretty weird not to. Meg's headphones ran out of battery halfway through the recording, and we had to change the setup slightly, but it's going to sound a bit like we recorded the second half on a completely different day. I promise we didn't. It was just a change of microphone. Actually, quite annoyingly, the one we switched to for the second half sounded way better than the first one, but I just wanted to explain that so that you weren't wondering what happened when that change does come rather abruptly. Anyway, here's Meg Massey.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
I was definitely a theater kid. I was not necessarily from a theater family. Our theater experience when in my childhood was very much sort of the annual local pantomime starring Fraser Hines from Emmerdale. That was my childhood theatre experiences. My mum sent me to Stagecoach, which was like a Saturday morning drama school when I was a precocious little child. But also, I think, to build my confidence in a weird way. And that was the beginning of the end, because that is what really just awakened me to theatre. I think my first theatre memory probably was my grandmother took me to see what must have been a regional touring production of South Pacific. So I remember that was probably the first proper show I saw in a theatre, and it absolutely blew my mind. I mean, I was obsessed with it for about 6 months afterwards, and I must have been 8 or 9 at that time. And then around about the time of being probably 10 or 11, I became obsessed with Cats, the musical. I had the VHS tape. In fact, I had 2 copies of the VHS tape. I had one that I watched, and I had another one that I hid in case my mum ever punished me for something by taking away my Cats video. So I had to spare just in case. I used to watch, you're learning so much about me. I used to watch Cats every day, and I would choreograph my own routines, and I would perform them for my grandparents on a Sunday afternoon when I went to their house and made them watch Cats. So I was very, very obsessed with Cats. And so I guess probably it must have been like my 12th birthday or something. That would have been my first trip to London to actually see a musical. And we went to see Cats, which I almost didn't want to do because I thought that seeing it would ruin it for me because it wouldn't be the same people as the people in the recording. But it was wonderful. And I was even more obsessed with it than before. I still love Cats. Cats is great.
And how did all of that carry on to a point where you decided you wanted to perform professionally? Because you trained at LSMT, right?
I did, yes. Well, I think it comes from being that sort of quite good, you know, little girl. I was quite good. And I think that being told I was quite good and being encouraged, being sort of, you know, of that, we're very much of that generation of you can do anything, you can be whatever you want to be. And so, of course, I was like, well, then I want to be in Cats. And that honestly, that is what set me on the path. I just wanted to be in Cats. And so I went to all of the, you know, I went to my Saturday stage school, I went to my dance classes. I was never going to be good enough to be in Cats, but I was just very determined that that was the world that I wanted to be in. And then I just became really obsessed with musical theatre when I was a teenager. And, you know, I was in my music class and my drama class, and I went to college to study acting and musical theatre. And then I moved to London when I was 18, because that was what was always in my plan. I was going to get out of my small town countryside life and move to London without a penny to my name. and you know, and then I started working in theatre. Like, my first job was working front of house in theatre. It's just, I always knew I needed to be in theatre and I was going to be a famous actress. That was the goal. So I got jobs working front of house, then I got jobs working backstage, then I went on a little regional tour in a show called The Cosmic Crew and The Search for the Cosmic Crystal. And I came out from that and I thought I should probably get some actual formal training. So that was when I went to LSMT, which is London School of Musical Theatre. And it was about 2 weeks into being at London School of Musical Theatre that I realised I was really not good enough to be a professional actress. Very aware of my... Yeah, it was quite an expensive lesson to learn, but I realized that quite early on. And I think at that time I also realized, but I still want to be in this industry. And so I'm throwing my absolute everything into making sure that happens in some way or other. So, you know, I loved that year of being at LSMT, but I came out and I went straight into working in the West End in various forms.
Right. So you were never a jobbing actress after you trained?
No.
Not at all.
Right. No, I was not. I think, you know, I came out, I just think I figured it out quite quickly. And then I stuck it out for a year. Well, it was only a year course, but through that year I was really trying, you know, I really gave it my all. But it was a realistic thing, you know, when you're surrounded by amazing, incredible talents, many of whom are now working in the West End, and I'm super happy for them and, you know, have got some of my lifelong friends from that experience. But I knew it was not a career choice for me. I knew that if you got me there in the room auditioning for a West End show, I wasn't going to get there. And weirdly, I was kind of okay with it. I feel like I'd gone through... I think I burned out quite a few times by that point, which I know we're going to talk about, but I threw myself into everything so hard that I think by that point, it was actually a little bit of a relief not to go into the world as a jobbing actress and have to realize it, you know, in the audition room. So yeah, I came straight into production from there.
I never even started that process purely because I knew people who were training and had just graduated right around the time that I would have had to make those decisions. So of course, you know, while 99% of people who get into theatre, that is how it starts, you know, an interest in performing and that kind of thing. Before I even had to make that decision, I saw it be so difficult for so many really talented people I knew were really talented that I just thought, oh, I don't want it that much. Like, I just want to, you know, I just want to stroll onto the stage and do it. I don't want to work. That sounds exhausting. Yeah.
I mean, I do think I did work pretty hard up until that point, but you can work your ass off. But if you don't have the talents, and you know, I had talent, I could sing, I can act. I just knew I would be in a room with people belting out, you know, Defying Gravity and going, that is lovely. I love you very much and you're very impressive and I can't wait to come and see you in the show. But actually I'm realizing that is not really a reality for me. So I best figure out what I'm going to do and what I'm going to do really well so I can be massively successful in this industry, which was my goal and, you know, my main priority at the time. Because right. I was that small town countryside kid who had gone to the big smoke and she would be damned if she was coming back having failed.
Right. So. You wanted to have something to something to show for it when you got back. Mm-hmm. And so then what was the career path from there? Sort of what was the CV from that point onwards?
So right at the beginning, I mean, I worked front of house in quite a few places. and in merchandise and in box office. So I really got a feel of kind of how theatres worked really early on, you know, and I was 19, 20 at this point. I worked backstage a bit. I was a dresser for a while. I did a little stint at Sea Tickets back in the day early on. And through that, I kind of did a couple of weeks interning with Stage Entertainment. And so at this time, I was really getting into my idea of networking. So I was kind of, I was making connections with this other side of the industry after I'd decided the performing side was not for me. And that's how I ended up kind of through all of these different connections and my early days of networking. I got a junior level job at AKA. And that was when I was about 21, I'm going to say. And I was at AKA for 7 years. I worked my way up. I learned loads. I worked on some absolutely incredible projects that, you know, I look back on those days in my early 20s and I did so much amazing stuff that I really, really loved. But I still worked myself into the ground quite a lot. I very much overloaded myself on a regular basis when I was in that job. And so I think that was kind of the early warning signs of the way that my life was going to go. I went from there to Sonia Friedman Productions and I was working on Cursed Child. And that was my sort of latest job to date in the entertainment industry because I was international marketing director. So I was working on all the productions all around the world. And that was my trajectory up until the point of my burnout.
Right. And so we're getting to the point where we're going to talk about that moment. Before we talk about exactly what happened sort of at that exact time, how much of it was that specific sort of moment you were in versus, as you say, the sort of 7-8 years before that of, was it sort of a gradually building, bubbling up thing?
Oh my God, yes. Yeah, right. It was absolutely a build up over 12 years. You know, I look back over sort of 12 years in the entertainment industry. And it's so interesting with the benefit of hindsight. And this is why I really feel like I'm kind of able to have these insights now that I look back on it. And now that I look back on it with the aid of a really great therapist. But, you know, when I look back on my attitude towards life and career, my obsession with my work and, you know, my obsession with being successful, very much a perfectionist, very, very concerned about what other people thought, making sure that other people were happy with what I was doing, were impressed with what I was doing, very much that kind of mindset of small town girl needs to go and be really successful so that everybody back home knows just how successful she is. And I think I carried that with me all the way through that. I think also the fact that I had sort of set out to go down that performance path and I diverted, you know, I felt a real pressure to make sure that I really justified that career diversion and that it was always part of the plan and I would be just as successful, if not more so, going down this new route that I went. So, you know, it was all of that pressure that I very much put on myself. And the fact that although I didn't know it at the time, I had been dealing with anxiety since my childhood. And that was very much building up and building up and building up my very unhealthy attitudes towards working, which were, I will do all the work. I will work all the hours. I will take all the pressure. Just gimme, gimme, gimme. And, you know, I'm wanting to progress as quickly as I possibly could. So, yeah, I think it really built up over the years. And I think, you know, I just had no ability to look after myself while doing all of that other stuff.
Did you have any sort of end goal in your theatre career other than that? Was the pure motivation sort of the optics of it? Or did you have a point, a certain role or a certain point in your career that you really wanted to get to where you felt you would be able to say, I've done it, I've made it?
It's so interesting looking back on it because I don't think I ever thought that far ahead. And also, I know that at the time, if you'd asked me this, I would have no such clarity. I know, looking back, how much I was driven by my anxiety and my, you know, desperation to please and to impress and to, you know, be accepted. But at the time, I just was on a career trajectory that I thought was going really, really well. So I didn't necessarily have an end goal. Everything that came along in my career actually was quite a surprise. And everything that came along was sort of a happy accident. Everywhere I ended up, I was always sort of going, oh, this is amazing. I'm loving doing this and I'm really good at it. And, you know, I just kept falling into things that I was really good at and that I could succeed at. And so I was happy with what was unfolding because I was happy to see where that took me ultimately. Until the point where my body caught up and went, actually, no, you can't keep going on this trajectory. You really need to listen. And I didn't listen. And then I collapsed from burnout and exhaustion. And here we are.
Right. Well, then I suppose that's as good a time as any to talk about the ultimate burnout moment.
Sure.
So wherever you want to start, you know, days, weeks, months before the big day feels like a crass way to say it, but you know what I mean. Leading up to hitting that point, what was going on?
I mean, I'd been very, very stressed for a very long time. And I had been working very hard and working very long hours for a very long time. And I think that was, you know, that was obviously a factor. And then it was also twinned with this buildup of stress and anxiety and pressure that had been building up on me over years and years and years. I would say I burned out a good 3 months before I guess everybody realized I had. I think I felt it. I think it happened. And I just kept carrying on and kept pushing myself, sort of going, I just need to get through this bit. I just need to take a rest. I just need to have a weekend or a holiday and then I'll be fine. And I think that is the way, that's a trap a lot of people fall into. My big dramatic breakdown moment, though, that I like to call it, came when I think when my body sort of gave up as well. I think my mind and soul burned out and my body kept pushing and kept going until one silly little thing just pushed me over the edge and I completely collapsed and had to be taken to a doctor, taken to a therapist and put on that track for recovery. I very much could not have done that myself at the time. And so I was very lucky that I had the support around me that I did to get me the help I needed.
So let's talk about burnout then and sort of now that it's been a while, because I mean, it's been what, a little over a year since sort of that moment hit, right?
14 months there and about. It really hit me at the end of 2019. So
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And so we're going to be talking about sort of your new life as a burnout coach and that kind of thing. And we'll talk about the theatre specific issues that you've learned about kind of in a moment. But beyond just talking about the arts, sort of what are the circumstances in a workplace that lead up to burnout kind of more broadly, kind of at a top level?
Burnout is complete and utter emotional and physical exhaustion. So it's more than being tired. It's more than being stressed. It's that point when you just can't anymore. It's really connected with depression and anxiety and all of those sort of psychological factors that I am not qualified to delve into, but that was very much my experience and what happened to me. So it's emotional and physical exhaustion. It's disconnection and apathy. Is a word that comes into the definition quite a lot. It's losing your passion. And this is so relevant, I think, for everybody who goes through that burnout experience. It's when you've worked so hard and so long at something you are so passionate for, and when you suddenly lose that passion, when you suddenly just don't want to do it anymore, and when you just can't bring yourself to get out of bed, it's really scary and it's really saddening when you suddenly lose that passion for the thing that defined so much of who you are and everything that you do. And then thirdly, it can be poor performance or it can be a perception of poor performance. I mean, ultimately, when you are exhausted physically, mentally, and emotionally, when you're disconnected to protect yourself from the constant anxiety, stress, and depression that you're dealing with, and you've become apathetic to what you're actually doing, and you've lost the will and lost the desire to keep going with what you're doing, then ultimately your performance is either going to be affected or you're going to feel like it's affected and that everybody's judging you for that. So that's kind of what burnout is. How it manifests is in so many different ways: chronic fatigue, anxiety, depression, insomnia, negativity, apathy, emotional exhaustion, frustration, anger, memory problems. People like forget things, lose their memories, find that fuzzy brain and brain fog. It can manifest as like physical symptoms, like illness, like headaches, migraines, just this kind of idea of self-doubt and loss of who you are and loss of what makes you happy. And just, it really is very isolating in that way. So kind of it manifests in so many ways. And the actual causes of it are many. I could list so many. And also I want to stress that it's not just work. Like, we're obviously talking about this in terms of work because I was a very career-driven person and my burnout very much kind of came about because of the way that I was pushing myself career-wise. But a lot of the time it can come from responsibility of caring, whether it's, you know, being a professional carer or looking after kids or looking after relatives or looking after other family members. It can be connected with a relationship, a toxic kind of relationship, or it can be, of course, work-related. So chronic continuous stress, that's the top one. Right. So when you know, there's stress and then there's chronic stress, and chronic stress over a prolonged period of time essentially equates to a trauma. And so that's essentially what you're putting your body and your mind through, that complete lack of respite, lack of release from that. A toxic environment is going to contribute to that, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a work environment, whether it's a family environment, and that very much that experience of not being able to escape from that environment. Practical things like an overloaded schedule, no rest or downtime, like no boundaries, all of that is going to contribute to it and cause and be a cause of burnout. There's all personality traits: perfectionists, overachievers, people pleasers, very much primed for burnout and very much quite a defining feature, I think, of a lot of people that work in this industry, which is what I think we're going to talk about in a little bit, but just why it's so rife in the entertainment world. Mm. And then in terms of actually the structure around you, like an imbalance of care, you caring a lot and working really hard and pushing yourself to care for something and that same care not being returned to you. So whether it's a lack of HR support, if it's in a work environment, a poor support structure around you, you know, bad management, frankly, a lot of this stuff can come down from the top. And when there's a structure at the top that kind of trickles down and affects the worker bees below, that can contribute to burnout for those on the worker bee level. And, you know, long working hours is obviously a factor as well. So it's like all of these different things. I feel like that's a really rambling answer to give you, but it's like a little checklist people can go through and go, oh, yeah, that's me. That's me. Oh, that's not me, but that's me. So, you know, this is all what I've learned in the last year of talking to so many people in so many industries that have gone through similar experiences. There are external factors: the environment that you're in, the way that you're supported and looked after. And then there are personality factors, having that unbalanced mindset of being desperate to please, being desperate to take on as much as you possibly can, needing to be perfect, needing to deliver.
Yeah. And what do you think the balance of those two things are? Because obviously you and I both know people who have gone through, you know, a career of 40 years in this industry and been able to make it through. And that's, you know, possibly because they don't have that personality type where they take it so personally and really feel it on their shoulders. They just see it as going to work. Whereas there's plenty of people, yourself included, it sounds like, who really do take it very personally and, like, you know, they make their job a big part of their identity. What do you think the balance is of kind of employee versus employer when it's a workplace career-related burnout?
It's a lovely balance of overachievers and opportunists. Right, I think that there's such an attitude, you know, of, I'm not going to say even younger generation, because actually, you know, I don't think it's something that is specific to a particular generation, but a sort of entry level, you know, when you come into a job, you want to just, you're desperate to please, you want to work so hard. And of course, if you're, you know, in a position of power within a company and you've got this, you know, really great individual that wants to take on more work, is asking for more work, then you've got a chance to give it to them. And it's not malicious, it's just the sort of structure. You've got an opportunity to load on work to this enthusiastic young soul who just loves everything about the world that they're in and the job that they're doing. And so they take on more and more work, and quite often, you know, people are quite happy to give it to them. But, you know, then there are those survivors who are still there, and as you say, who've got these like thriving careers and have that balance. And and I'm super impressed with that, because I know how all-encompassing it can be. I think you're absolutely right that it is personality traits. You know, I think if you have a different mindset, if you can separate work from life, then you're absolutely on a stronger footing, you know, to be able to avoid that burnout and to find that balance from the get-go. So many of us don't separate work from life. So many of us, I think, in this industry, our whole lives are our work. I think that, you know, our social circle, our work circle, obviously, but also our passion as well. Going to the theatre is what we love to do. Other people that work in theatre love to go to theatre, so we go to theatre together, you know. And it's really something that has been interesting for me, talking to various people since COVID and the lockdown and since everything has happened, that people have lost their entire social circles because their whole lives revolved around going into the office, going into the theatre, going for drinks afterwards. And suddenly there's only so many Zoom calls you can attend, having a glass of wine on a Friday night, before it just loses its, you know, there's nothing else to talk about beyond when's theatre coming back. So that's been really, really interesting to see.
Yeah. So we've talked about the responsibilities on both sides. Obviously, it sounds like on the employee side, on the personal side, you're saying, you know, finding a little more balance and trying to sort of draw those lines between work and social, even if it's the same kind of people, like try and break that up a little bit more. On the employer side, at what point is it, oh, here's someone who's enthusiastic versus now it's someone being opportunistic and putting work on someone that, you know, they might not be able to handle? How do you kind of identify where that line changes?
I think that's such a huge question. And honestly, I think it's one that I am not ready to tackle and answer. Mm-hmm, because sure. I think it's a huge, huge challenge. I think there is a massive shift that needs to happen, not just in our industry, in so many industries. And I think it's been really highlighted by our experience with COVID over the last year. You know, we've seen that we can do so much working from home. You know, we can be really productive in a 4-hour morning, more so than we might be in a 10-hour day in the office, you know, with distractions everywhere. So, you know, that we know that the world can adapt. We know it doesn't have to stay the same and be exactly the same day after day. But that's not going to change overnight. And that is going to need more than just one person deciding that it needs to change. You know, I think the big thing is that we have to value people the same way that we value the ones in front of the curtain and on the stage. You know, I think it's not going to be an overnight shift. But I also think that the first step of that is that people need to start valuing themselves. I want to help the individuals. There's a lot of people out there, a lot of really amazing experts who I've been in contact with over the last year, who specialize in going into organizations, looking at the structures and going, okay, here are some changes that you can make in order to actually help your employees thrive and keep that balance and ultimately make them more productive and better workers overall for the organization. Like, that's not something I do, and that's not something I really want to do. I want to help the people who are in that place, who need to start making changes for themselves, because a lot of the time it's become an issue with self-worth. A lot of the time it's become an issue with how you view yourself and what you feel that you deserve. And I think, you know, really getting to the root of that, knowing who you are, knowing what makes you happy, knowing what drives you, and knowing who you are away from what you do is the first step, I think, in terms of finding balance. And then comes in the actual practical things that I work with clients in terms of coaching on, of like how to set boundaries, how to create those self-care practices in your daily life, how to make sure that you're getting enough sleep, how to make sure you're getting enough, you know, regular meals and exercise and all of that. But the first step is making sure that we actually value ourselves and we know our worth.
Hmm. And how do you think gender plays into all of this? By which I mean women feeling like they need to work harder than men. Well, sorry, that's patronizing. Women having to work harder than men for the same level of respect, especially in that sort of middle to high level space, in the kind of role you were in, where you're making really major and significant decisions and kind of leadership choices, but you're not necessarily yet, you know, a female theater owner or a Tony winner or something like that, sort of in that middle office ground. How much of it do you think is a gender issue?
I think the pressures are different. Obviously, the patriarchy is a problem. And I've witnessed a lot of sexism and misogyny over my time, over the last 12 years. And I've had plenty of dodgy experiences. I mean, you know, I've been very lucky in that I've worked in very sort of female-led environments. So I've had quite positive experiences in a lot of ways.
I suppose more so my question is, in the clients that you've been speaking with over the last year, I guess what's the ratio? Is really a simpler question.
Right. Most of them are women. Absolutely. Most of the clients that I work with are women. But I think in a way, that's because I'm a woman. And so, you know, there's that relatability there. But I have also talked to plenty of men in the entertainment industry, coming from a, you know, theatre industry and a bit wider. And that's a different experience, you know, for them. They still struggle with others' opinion of them. They still struggle with the perception of speaking out and saying that they're struggling. I think that, you know, toxic masculinity is as much of an issue for them as female inequality is for us. So it's, in regards to this specific experience of burnout, I've seen it more in women, but burnout is a male problem just as much as it is a female one.
And so to talk now about Maggie Supernova and your new your sort of new life, once you had accepted that you had burned out and you couldn't just take a long weekend, as you said before, and pick it back up again.
Yeah.
What was the thought process behind deciding to make burnout coaching your new career? You've admitted to me before it was quite soon after it happened for you to start coaching other people about it. But clearly you were passionate about doing it and sharing what you'd learned even after just a few months. Why was that?
Well, I mean, I didn't really start coaching until quite a bit later, I would say. But so my healing kind of process was such a learning experience for me. And I think just because of the personality that I am and my attitudes towards having to be the best, which maybe is something I'm still dealing with. But when I started that healing process, I was very much like, I am going to read all the books. I am going to go to all the therapy. I'm going to listen to all the podcasts. I'm going to soak up all the knowledge and I'm going to be the best at healing, which ultimately led me to burnout again while trying to get better. So that was a learning experience in itself. But I really went through a sort of like self-imposed rehabilitation process, really, because I really just locked myself away. I focused on getting better. I focused on actually sort of healing the physical aspects of what had happened to me in terms of the exhaustion. But also I really got to work on the mindset and the anxiety and the inner stuff, you know, processing everything. It was really educational for me because I just realized that there were so many simple things I could do that really helped. Regularly going to yoga classes and doing that kind of much more restorative kind of practice, and starting meditation and getting really into my meditation and going to therapy regularly and structuring my days and doing all of the work that I was doing. And I started just sharing it with people, you know, friends and colleagues or former colleagues, you know, in the short term, just because it was the experience that I was going through, and all of the interesting stuff that I was learning. And then I realized that what I was learning was helping them as well. And so then obviously COVID happened, the lockdown happened, and I was sort of forced to step back from everything. I left London because I lived in a flat without a garden. And if I could be in the countryside at my parents' house, then I was going to be. So I left London. I came out to the countryside. I started training to become a yoga teacher. I did a meditation course. I just started soaking up all of this stuff and realizing that it was really helping me, like learning all of the things that would help me and would also help others, was really rewarding. And the people that I was talking to and the people that I was helping at the time, when I sort of started coaching before really knowing that I was going to go down that path, were getting a lot of benefits from it. So I started to look at it seriously kind of in the late summer, and then set up my business sort of September, October time last year, and rolled out from there. And it's been going, you know, it's been going really well. It's been a real experience of kind of building up slowly and figuring out what I'm doing, but knowing that I have found something I'm good at, which is helping people not make the same mistakes that I did.
Right. And what exactly is a burnout coach now in your eyes? If you had to give your job description in a few sentences now, what would you be writing down?
I think that the first thing to note is a coach in any capacity is not a therapist. It's very different to that side of things. So whereas a therapist deals a lot more with kind of going back into childhood and finding the root causes of why you are the way that you are, a coach is a little bit more practical of like, okay, so this is the way you are. How are we moving forward from there? What I do is I help really frazzled, stressed out people, usually women, in starting to build that plan for getting their lives back on track. And not only getting their lives back on track, but also figuring out what it is that they actually want from life and what it is that's going to make them happy. Because that was the huge game changer for me, was realizing how unhappy I was doing what I thought was my absolute dream, and realizing that, you know, so much of my own limiting beliefs were stopping me from actually being happy. And so happiness has become my priority. Happiness and balance are my priorities in life. I am pretty happy now. And I've learned how to enjoy life, and I've learned how to appreciate life. And I'm really enjoying the process. And so I help other people figure out how to be happy, and then I help them get there.
And what sort of response have you had so far from your friends and your former colleagues who are still in the theatre industry to, you know, whatever extent they can be right now? Have you mostly been dealing with people in theatre and the arts? Has that been most of the clientele that you've had?
A lot of industry colleagues sliding into my DMs.
Sure.
So, you know, that's been brilliant, because it's been, the response has actually been really positive, in that, in any capacity. It's worked really well, because I've worked with burnout coaches, you know, and I've been coached myself in my own recovery. And it's really interesting how unique I think the theatre industry is. And yet the experience that most of the people that I've been working with have had, I can relate so much to it. And, you know, when we talk about stuff, there's a shorthand of, you know, just because I know what it's like. I've been there. I know how the industry works. I know how the people work. So that's been really great, because, you know, I think it's just kind of, once you get to talk to somebody who speaks your language, then you can move forward and progress a lot more quickly and a lot more effectively.
You've been part of discussion groups and webinars and a few different things now that I've seen on your social media pages. I know you've been taking to Clubhouse recently. As both a participant and a facilitator in a number of forums. What have you found are the commonalities from other lines of work, and what's totally unique to theatre? What are the things you don't hear from people who experienced in other businesses that perhaps you expected to, based on your personal experience?
I think it's the passion and the way that we feel so personally invested in what we do. I think that's the real standout thing for me, because I do actually, I'm part of a Clubhouse room every Tuesday at 8 p.m. UK time, 3 p.m. Eastern time. All of the different coaches and experts in there have all come to experience burnout in different industries. And so we talk about it in terms of different perspectives from different industries and different experiences. But the thing that I really feel is unique to the arts is that our work is our dream and our passion and what we have been driven to do since we were, you know, little theatre kids. And I think a lot of people, it's not everybody, but it's my experience, and I know it's a lot of people's experiences. When you don't fit in as a kid, when you find your tribe and your people who are your theatre people, whether it's in high school in theatre groups, whether it's at college, whether it's in the industry itself, you know, you desperately cling to that. It's about finding acceptance. It's about finding identity, and it's about fulfilling that dream and that passion.
And so, well, I think that is why it hits us so hard. I think that a lot of people will have experienced this since the COVID lockdowns and since the industry has obviously been hit so hard, is that suddenly overnight, if your industry is taken away, if everything that you are is taken away, then it's really devastating. And actually, that was kind of what happened to me. You know, overnight, I stepped away for the sake of my own mental health, and for the sake of my own happiness and future life. And suddenly, my whole life was completely different. Everything that I'd known was gone. And, you know, I had some real interesting learning experiences with who friends actually were, who stuck around, who was surprising to still be there and still be in my life and still be a friend, and who was surprising to not be there anymore. I think that's what it is. I think that the unique thing about theatre is that it is our entire lives. It's our entire passion. And so it hits us so hard when it kind of turns against us, when burnout strikes. We push ourselves so hard because it's our everything, because it's our whole world, and because we love it. And it's a wonderful thing, but it's not the only thing. And this is the big lesson I've learned. And I think from listening to the podcast, you know, listening to some of the things, I've loved the episodes with workers who are furloughed or workers who have lost their jobs. You know, I've really found it really interesting listening to their perspectives of finding out a life outside the theatre and recognising what that is. And some of them are really enjoying it despite the challenges, obviously, and some of them are absolutely hating it and desperate to come back. And it's just really, it's really interesting how everybody's kind of getting this opportunity to take a step back and to see what life is outside of the industry.
Yeah, it very much feels like the sort of glasses have come off for a second. It's like when the Matrix fails, you know. I wanted to also talk about the role of yoga in what you've been doing, because as well as burnout coaching, you're also teaching yoga now. And looking at your website and social media profiles and the like, the two seem to be pretty deeply intertwined for you. I rarely see a post about one without the other. What's the role of yoga in your particular brand of burnout coaching, and do you feel both are necessary, or are they actually two sort of standalone things that you do?
Yeah, for me, it's absolutely hand in hand combined. I also got really into meditation, and I write and guide meditations as part of my offering and what I do as well. For me, yoga, because I always did yoga before. We've been to a yoga class. I used to do, you know, hot sweaty yoga in a candlelit room with hip hop music playing in the background, because that was the kind of workout that I used to like to do, you know, something that I really felt like if I was going to go and work out, I wanted to just sweat out my eyeballs, that kind of level of exercise. So when I burned out, I remember my therapist saying to me, you know, do you exercise? Like, what kind of exercise do you do? And I was like, yeah. So I go to SoulCycle and I go to a boxing class. And she was like, whoa, how about something a little bit gentler? And so I went to my local yoga studio, and I signed up for a yin yoga class, which I'd sort of heard of, but not really, but it was candlelit. So I thought, that kind of sounds like what I used to do. And I walked into this room, and I kid you not, like, it was the most zen space I have ever been in. It was, you know, the mats were all laid out, but on the mats were all of these squishy bolster cushions and bean bags and blankets and all sorts of props that I'd never seen before in a yoga class. And so my first experience of that kind of really slow, steady, still yoga. Because if you don't know what yin yoga is, it's really different. It's really still. So you get into quite a simple pose and you stay there for like 5 minutes. And then you get into another simple pose and you stay there for 5 minutes. And, you know, each one of those poses, it's all about completely relaxing the body. It's all about going deeper than the muscles and really getting into the joints and the connective tissues and everywhere that we hold stress and tension in our bodies. And for me, it was a release of something that I didn't even know I was holding on to. You know, I remember really, really early in a class, I was like in a child's pose, which anyone who's done yoga class knows is absolutely the best pose in the world. And I was in this child's pose, and the teacher came over and just really gently laid her hand on my back in between my shoulder blades. And just that, she didn't really press or anything. It was just like that gentle pressure. And it unlocked something in me that was just mortifying, because I just like immediately started crying. And it was just this release of emotion that I didn't know was there. And that was so transformative. I think my first experience of that, I just went, wow, I need some more of this in my life. And so I became hooked from then on. And so when I started my yoga teacher training, which is, you know, your sort of initial training is generally in more of a vinyasa, ashtanga, hatha kind of more dynamic practice. So I did that because I had to get the qualification in order to teach, you know, professionally. But then I dived into yin yoga and restorative, more healing yoga practice. And it's just such a way of connecting with yourself, connecting with your body, connecting with your breath and relaxing your mind and releasing emotion and pent up frustration and anxiety and stress, that I've just become addicted to it. And I recommend it to absolutely everybody that I work with. And so I teach that class really regularly. I invite all of my clients to come to it. When I'm working one-on-one with a client, each week through the program, they'll get a special yin yoga class that's, you know, created specifically with that theme of that session in mind. So it really goes hand in hand. And the same with meditation, because meditation was something that I thought was so embarrassing when I was first, when someone first suggested it to me. I was like, yeah, all right, meditation. And then I tried it. And again, I realized it didn't give me that release like the yoga did, but it gave me that calm and it gave me that moment of quiet in my mind and just a chance to process everything. So both of those absolutely go hand in hand. I teach a meditation class every week and a yoga class every week. And they connect with what I'm doing in terms of coaching and helping people with burnout recovery. They're very much intertwined.
Given all of this and everything that we've talked about, going back, I suppose, to the girl who had two copies of Cats squirreled away for emergencies, yeah. What's your relationship with theatre now? Obviously, it's quite easy at the moment to say, you know, I'm not thinking about a theatre job because there are none. But post-pandemic, do you see yourself even considering going back to the theatre in something less intense and sort of with this new awareness that you've built up? Or do you really feel you're just 100% sort of done with it now?
I mean, right now, I'm loving what I'm doing. I'm really enjoying living in the countryside and having space. And I have a puppy, so I'm enjoying being a puppy mum. Currently, I have no plans to return to theatre. But I have decided not to put limits on myself anymore, because I think that is a trap I always used to fall into. I decided that I was going to achieve something and I would work tirelessly to achieve it and accept anything else, or I wouldn't accept anything else. Anything other than perfection was failure. So I'm not going to limit myself to five-year plans anymore, and I'm not going to say yes or no. But where I am right now, how I'm feeling right now, I feel like I'm on a different path now. And I'm actually really looking forward to going back to the theatre and watching a show and enjoying a show and loving seeing that art form and not having to be in any way stressed about it. So that's how I feel my relationship with theatre is at the moment. I'm so excited for it to come back because I want to see it again.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Maggie Supernova's Meg Massey. And you can find out more about Meg's journey and her work as a burnout coach, as well as information on her coaching programs, yoga classes, and meditation sessions by checking out at Maggie Supernova Coach on Instagram or by visiting maggiesupernova.com. That's M-A-G-G-I-E Supernova. If you enjoyed today's episode, please do share it on social media and head to your podcast app of choice to rate, review, and follow or subscribe. Some other housekeeping, the Broadway Podcast Network is thrilled to announce that we now have a dedicated iOS app for discovering and enjoying all of your Broadway-themed content on the go. You'll also get exclusive bonus content and early releases of new episodes if you choose to listen over there, so do check it out. That's available on the App Store or at bpn.fm/app. Putting It Together is produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals for the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Ulis Pekan, and artwork and editing is by me, Ollie Southgate. You can find me on Twitter, I'm at Ollie Southie, or take a look at my website, that's olliesouthgate.com. In both cases, my name is spelled with an I-E, not a Y. I'll be back on the first Friday of April, so that's Friday, April 2nd. But until then, thanks as always for listening, and goodbye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.